From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're listening to the Best of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present a previously recorded episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank's guest is Dr. Stephen C. Meyer, Director of the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle, and author of Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
Welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And today is going to be the quintessence of that reality. On the podcast today, I have Dr. Stephen Meyer. He received his PhD from the University of Cambridge, and that PhD is in the philosophy of science. He's a former geophysicist. He's a college professor, and he now directs the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle. He has written three of the most incredible books we have ever featured through the ministry of the Christian Research Institute and our various outreaches. One of them is the New York Times bestseller Darwin's Doubt, subtitled The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. The second is Signature in the Cell, a landmark work. And then his latest book titled Return of the God Hypothesis. And the subtitle is very instructive. We'll talk about this, but the subtitle says Three Scientific Discoveries, Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. And what is so great about this particular work is that Dr. Meyer explains extremely complicated subjects in extraordinarily accessible ways. And I think that's the genius, not only of this book, but all of his work. We have appreciated Dr. Meyer for many years at the Christian Research Institute and just delighted to host him on Hank Unplugged. Hi, Dr. Meyer.
Hello, Hank. It's great to be with you. It's been too long since we've talked, but I fear it's a consequence of how long it's taken me to write another book. So thanks for having me on.
Well, you know, it's often said that either the writer struggles or the reader struggles. And in your case, I'm sure you struggled. It took you a long time to be able to communicate what you communicate in the Return of the God Hypothesis in such a transferable way. I think people can read this book, grasp its content, and then make a difference for time and for eternity.
Well, I certainly hope so. I think one of the things that you and I are both aware of is that in our culture today, we have a growing group of agnostics and atheists, especially among young people. The pollsters are picking up this phenomena they call the rise of the nuns, the religiously non or unaffiliated young agnostics and atheists. And when you probe that group with polling questions, it turns out that science has played an outsized role in their disaffection with religious belief. 76% of young atheists say that the findings of science have made belief in God less probable. And I wrote this book in part because I've been thinking for 35 years about many findings of science that I think make belief in God not only more probable, but actually the best explanation for key discoveries about the origin of the universe, its finely tuned structure, and the origin of life.
Your book starts with a gripping story. It's the story of your debate with Lawrence Krauss, along with Dennis Lemereau. And that actually served as the inspiration for writing The Return of the God Hypothesis. The story, I say, is gripping because when I started reading your book, I couldn't put it down from that opening story on through the end of the book itself.
Yeah, well, thank you. It wasn't maybe the most pleasant night I've ever had doing a public event or a talk or a debate. I usually enjoy those things. And I debated Professor Krauss twice before, but on this particular night, it was at the University of Toronto. There were approximately 60,000 people watching online and 1,000 or 1,200 in the auditorium. It was an electric, intense atmosphere under very bright lights. And at that point in my life, I was struggling with migraines, and bright light had been a trigger. And I got about 18 minutes into the 25-minute opening talk, and I suddenly couldn't see my slides. I was getting what are called ARA, little visual disruptions in my visual field. And then my voice started echoing in my own head. It was a kind of sequence that I know really well. But I also knew I was in serious trouble because it comes with something else called aphasia, which is the inability to pull words. And I kind of struggled through the last 7 minutes of the opening statement, tried to make my remarks as simple as possible. And there was a nice Canadian doctor who was driving me around, who pulled me off the podium and took me to a dark room while a third speaker, Dennis Lamoureux, spoke. Krauss had opened. And, you know, after that next 25-minute talk, I agreed I'd give it a shot. I came back and there was a, you know, spirited discussion. But there was a couple occasions in the discussion time when I actually yielded time because I was having trouble pulling words. And the one thing you never do as a debater is yield your time, you know. So, but at the very end of the debate, some of the symptoms started to dissipate a bit. And the moderator asked if we could summarize our key position about the topic of the debate that night, which was what lies behind it all. And I had come wanting to make an opening statement about intelligent design, but then in the discussion period, I'd wanted to explain what I thought about what science could tell us about the identity of the designing intelligence responsible for life. And I found myself, partly because I was having to be very succinct, summarizing three key discoveries that I thought didn't just point to intelligent design, but had decidedly theistic implications. Number one, that the universe, as best we can tell, had a beginning. Number two, that from the beginning or very soon thereafter, the universe in its basic physical parameters has been finely tuned against all odds and for no underlying physical reason to allow for the possibility of life, to allow for a life-conducive universe. And then number three, the discovery that inside living cells, even the simplest living cells, we have found digital information and a complex information storage, transmission, and processing system that exceeds anything we've built ourselves in our advanced high-tech digital computing. And so I just quickly ticked off those three key discoveries and said that, you know, for me, the ensemble of things that we've learned, that suite of discoveries, those three things together point not just to a designing intelligence, but to a designing intelligence who has the attributes that Jews and Christians have long ascribed to God. Transcendence, an intelligence which is separate from the universe and therefore could bring it into existence and fine-tune it, but also an intelligence which is active in the creation and could bring about new forms of design and information long after the beginning, as we see in the origin of life. So after the debate, I got a lot of email from people who were very sympathetic about what I'd experienced with the migraine. And, you know, it was kind of interesting. Both the other debating partners were pretty aggressive, even when I was struggling with words. So I got a lot of, you know, sympathetic emails and that sort of thing. But the thing that really struck me was the number of people who said the one thing that they remembered about the content of the debate was that quick summary in the closing statement of those three facts. And I thought maybe it's time to write a book around those three facts and explain in more detail why I think they support what I call a God hypothesis.
You've already sort of hinted at this in your opening remarks, but I want to really underscore what you were hinting at, and that is the full implications of Darwinian evolutionary theory. And perhaps the best way that I can do that is to quote Professor of Philosophy at Duke University, Dr. Alex Rosenberg. And he's someone who overtly says that Darwinian evolution is the only game in town. And then he talks about the implications of the only game in town. First of all, he says that 95% of the most distinguished scientists in America don't believe in God. And then he says this, the other 5% simply swallowed the biggest conspiracy theory of them all. And that is the story of how God put us here, or that is the story of the God hypothesis. And then when he talks about God, he asks the question, is there such a thing as God? And then he says, no. What is the nature of reality? He answers what physics says it is. What is the purpose of the universe? His answer, there is none. What is the meaning of life? There is no meaning. Why am I here? Dumb luck. He goes on and on in this discussion and finally says, what is the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? And his answer, there is no moral difference between right and wrong, good and bad.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Dr. Stephen Meyer. Many intellectuals insist that science and belief in God are at war. In Return of the God Hypothesis, Stephen Meyer argues that theism, with its affirmation of a transcendent, intelligent, and active creator, best explains the evidence we have concerning our origins. Meyer provides an evidence-based answer to perhaps the ultimate mystery of the universe. The result? A stunning conclusion. The data support not only the existence of an intelligent designer of some kind, but the existence of a personal God. To receive your copy of Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.
Many intellectuals insist that science and belief in God are at war. In Return of the God Hypothesis, Stephen Meyer argues that theism, with its affirmation of a transcendent, intelligent, and active creator, best explains the evidence we have concerning biological and cosmological origins. Previously, Meyer refrained from attempting to answer questions about who might have designed life. Now he provides an evidence-based answer to the ultimate mystery of the universe. The results? Meyer reveals a stunning conclusion. The data support not just the existence of an intelligent designer of some kind, but the existence of a personal God. To receive your copy of Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.
Dr. Eben Alexander's wildly popular near-death experience book, Proof of Heaven, assures us that no matter what we do in this life, only unconditional love and joy await us in the world to come. But our Lord warned that while the gate to hell is wide, the road to it broad, and those who enter through it are many, the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Your generous support lets Hank Hanegraaff and CRI speak out against the lies that lead to hell. In appreciation for your gift today, we'll rush you Hank's book, Afterlife, What You Need to Know About Heaven, the Hereafter, and Near-Death Experiences, filled with answers to your questions about life after death. Call 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org now. Again, that's equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture, Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Dr. Stephen Meyer, in their conversation.
I want to really underscore the full implications of Darwinian evolutionary theory. And perhaps the best way that I can do that is to quote Professor of Philosophy at Duke University, co-director of the Duke Center for Philosophy of Biology, a man by the name of Dr. Alex Rosenberg. He asked the question, is there such a thing as God? And then he says, no. What is the nature of reality? He answers, what physics says it is. What is the purpose of the universe? There is none. What is the meaning of life? There is no meaning. Why am I here? Dumb luck. He goes on, and finally says, what is the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? And his answer, there is no moral difference between right and wrong, good and bad. He goes on to say, anything goes, and then concludes by asking, does history have meaning or purpose? And his answer is, it's full of sound and fury, but ultimately signifies nothing.
Yeah.
So here you have someone who is overtly communicating the implications of a universe without God.
Yeah, absolutely. The problem with that whole, it's an excellent explication of the implications of first materialist theories of origin, and secondly, the worldview built atop them known as scientific materialism. If all that exists fundamentally, if the things from which everything else came are simply matter and energy within some space and time, then it follows that there can be no meaning in any ultimate sense of human existence. Nothing can mean anything to a rock or a planet or an atom or a quark. Meaning is something that is conferred by persons and is arguably best found in relationship between persons. So if the universe does not have a personal source, if it was not created by a personal being with mind and intelligence and self-conscious awareness, then when we die, there can be no meaning left in the universe because there are no persons left to confer such meaning. So Rosenberg has done a very good job of explicating what follows from a materialistic worldview. And he claims that that worldview is justified by, in this case, Darwinian accounts of the origins of new forms of life. There are multiple problems, however, with his premise. Voltaire once said that madness is reasoning correctly from incorrect premises. To claim that human life has no meaning, I think you could classify as a form of madness, but it does follow deductively from an incorrect premise, that being materialism and the underlying claims about strictly materialistic accounts of how everything came to be. He is right about Darwinism. Darwinism is not just the idea that life evolved or that it changed over time, but rather the idea that life evolved by unguided, undirected processes, in particular, the process of natural selection acting on random mutation. What Rosenberg seems unaware of is that even within evolutionary biology, and indeed among elite evolutionary biologists, there is an increasing recognition that the mutation natural selection mechanism lacks the creative power necessary to account for new forms of life, for fundamental innovations in the history of life, as opposed to minor modifications. In 2016, I attended a conference at the Royal Society in London that was convened by a group of leading evolutionary biologists who are dissatisfied with what's called the modern synthesis, the standard textbook neo-Darwinian theory of evolution. And they are calling for a new theory of evolution, or at least new mechanisms of evolutionary change that can either replace or supplement the mutation selection mechanism, because they understand that it lacks the creative power to generate fundamental morphological innovations in the history of life. Now, this is taking place at the highest levels of evolutionary biology, this discussion. It was also interesting that at the conference, one of the prime movers in calling for its convening declared at the end that the conference was characterized by a lack of momentousness, that apparently the assessment was that the evolutionary biologists there did a good job of explaining the problems with neo-Darwinian theory without really coming up with any new mechanisms that could remedy the lack of creative power associated with the main Darwinian mechanism. So there are good reasons to reject the idea that neo-Darwinism has explained away all appearances of design in nature, which is one of its key claims, because the designer substitute mechanism, mutation and selection, lacks the creative power to do that. In addition, there is no evolutionary explanation, even a plausible evolutionary explanation, for the origin of the first life from simpler non-living chemicals. And yet, in even the simplest living cells, we have exquisite evidence of design, again, in the digital information that's present in the DNA and the RNA, and in the whole complex information processing system that stores and transmits and processes the information necessary to build the proteins that keep cells alive. So we've got compelling indicators of design in even the simplest living cells, and yet the origin of those cells has not been explained by an undirected chemical evolutionary process. So I think Professor Rosenberg is racing way ahead of what the evidence actually supports. He does a good job of explaining the implications of a materialistic worldview, but neither neo-Darwinism nor chemical evolutionary theories really provide the support for that materialistic account of origins that is necessary for that worldview to remain plausible, or still less, the default way of thinking for our scientific and wider culture.
And he's not alone. I mean, you have people like Richard Dawkins, who's made a cottage industry out of making dogmatic assertions without providing defensible arguments. So he'll say that the universe we observe has no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. And this seems to be one of those dogmatic assertions that he never really buttresses with evidence.
Well, that is, again, part of why I wrote the book, but also I love that quotation. If I could back it up just a clause or two, he actually says, before the part you quote, he says, the universe has exactly the properties we should expect if at bottom there is no design, no purpose, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Now, that's a very significant statement. First of all, I love the way these guys, Rosenberg, Krauss, Dawkins, the way they frame issues, because they really, unlike a lot of people in the culture, they do actually take the claims of revealed religion seriously. They just reject them completely outright and do so on the basis of putative evidence in support of their alternative worldview. And those are people you can actually have a discussion with because they are looking at the big questions. And one of the wonderful things about this quote from Dawkins is that he actually implies, very clearly implies, that worldviews or metaphysical systems of thought can be tested or evaluated the same way we would test a scientific theory, by looking at the evidence around us and seeing if what we observe in the natural world, seeing if its properties match what we would expect if a given worldview were either true or false. Now, by blind, pitiless indifference, and no purpose and no design, Dawkins is speaking of his default scientific materialistic or scientific atheistic worldview. And he's essentially saying that we can test whether or not that's true, because when we look at the properties of the universe, we can tell that the properties are such just as what we would expect if scientific materialism were true. I take that argument at face value, but head on, and say, but is that really the case? Is it the case that we would expect a universe, a physical universe of matter, space, time, and energy, giving evidence of having had a definite beginning in time, that matter, space, time, and energy began to exist a finite time ago? That is the implication of modern astrophysics and cosmology and something known as the Big Bang Theory or the inflationary cosmological models of the origin of the universe. No proponent of a materialistic worldview until recently has thought that that's what you would naturally expect. Materialism has always thought that matter and energy were eternal and self-existent and did not have a beginning. Secondly, materialists would not expect to find that the universe had been finely tuned against all odds, and again, as I said before, for no underlying physical reason, to allow for the possibility of life. This fine-tuning that physicists refer to and sometimes call the Goldilocks universe, where all these fundamental parameters, the strength of gravitational force, the mass of the elementary particles, the ratio of the strength of other fundamental forces to each other, the strength of the force that's driving the expansion of the universe, by which we also have come to understand something about its beginning. All of these fundamental parameters fall within very narrow ranges or tolerances that make life possible. Little tiny differences one way or another would render the universe a life-unfriendly place. And the odds of getting all of these things right is astronomically small. That's not something that you would expect on a materialistic worldview or on a naturalistic worldview.
Thank you for joining us for this special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Dr. Stephen Meyer, author of Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. To hear this Hank Unplugged podcast interview in its entirety, go to equip.org, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more.
Many intellectuals insist that science and belief in God are at war. In Return of the God Hypothesis, Stephen Meyer argues that theism, with its affirmation of a transcendent, intelligent, and active creator, best explains the evidence we have concerning biological and cosmological origins. Previously, Meyer refrained from attempting to answer questions about who might have designed life. Now he provides an evidence-based answer to the ultimate mystery of the universe. The results? Meyer reveals a stunning conclusion. The data support not just the existence of an intelligent designer of some kind, but the existence of a personal God. To receive your copy of Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org. That's equip.org.